There you go. Let it go. I don't want a dry pair of pants in the house on a dry but really, really cold, good Minnesota night. The truth is, I wish we could have gotten away from Dad, the raging alcoholic. I wish we were strong enough. I wish you were strong enough. Can I say that? Is that another way of calling you weak? I don't mean that. And what would we have done anyway? Live year-round on welfare? Obviously, you had something you needed to complete with Dad, something you felt you just couldn't give up. What was it, though? For one reason or another, you thought that, in the end, we were better off with him than without. I'll never really know. I understand that you had all these kids, and you must have told yourself, well, at least I know what I have with him. Maybe you told yourself there are worse men out there, and that maybe you would have ended up with that man. Or no one. I understand that it would have been a very hard road to leave him. If you had actually considered it, there weren't shelters then, places to hide out or to go for support, to leave kids for a while, as much as there are today. Though there should be more of those today and better support and services. I understand how hard it is because once you're on a well-worn path, it's easier to keep treading on it. I put easier in quotation marks because it's a lie, Mom. It isn't easier. But the path you're staying on, that we stayed on, we knew for certain it had monsters on it. We had seen them. We would see them again. They were always just about to jump out. And if alcoholism changed as it did with Dad and no longer ignited into violence, well, it morphed into something else later. A simmering, contemptuous meanness that was often far worse than an outburst. Because with an outburst, at least, you knew it'd be over quickly and you'd get a reprieve from the pain. That's a lie, too. To this day, Mom, I still think about the drunken abuse Dad doled out to you, hitting you, calling you a whore. There's a helplessness we all felt. Maybe you stayed with him because you loved him. And you knew that if you really worked hard or prayed enough or loved him enough, that he'd be able to turn it around. I'll stick it out, and I'll do the best I can, keep moving forward, and maybe something good will come around the corner. You were the most optimistic person, or the most stubborn, or the most determined. Maybe all three. You won in the end, 'cause he quit drinking. But he really never changed. And then he got sick. And physical health, or the lack of it, is the great equalizer. And when a loved one gets sick, everything else takes a backseat. It looks meaningless by comparison. Then it's just about survival. But why not emotional and psychological sickness? Why don't they stop us from what we're doing, so we can address that? Must it always be cancer before we press the pause button? I know, more questions than can ever be answered, but I had to ask. People talk about how drugs ruin lives, and they do. I'm not downplaying how terrible drugs can be, but marijuana is legal now, at least medical marijuana in some states. I'm all for it. It makes more sense to legalize weed than alcohol. Let's legalize marijuana in all states, and not just for medical purposes. Because we all need something and it helps us get through the pain. I get why people drink, but weed is a lot better. Then again, fans used to come up to me after the shows wanting me to smoke pot with them. And I told them, do I look like I need another reason to be hungry? The fallout from alcohol use is far worse than from marijuana use. I don't have statistics. I just know that alcoholism still affects my life. And Dad's been gone almost 40 years. I know that when you grow up in an alcoholic family, it's kind of like an atom bomb or a hydrogen bomb or any of those bombs where no one gets out unscathed. You're affected at the time and as time goes on. Its effects seep into your life, affecting everything you do from the friends you attract to the risks you take or don't take. To the whole life you try to lead. And how about drunk driving? You hardly, if ever, hear about someone smoking pot and then going out and recklessly killing someone because they fell asleep at the wheel because they veered into the other lane. You know what a four-way stop in Minnesota looks like with stoned Midwestern polite drivers? No one'll go.
You go. No, you go. He won't go. Please go.
Go. I'm not kidding. I'll go.
I know there are lots of drugs that if people were under the influence, it would be absolutely terrible for them to drive. But we know what drunk drivers do so often, not just severely damaging or ending the life of the drinker, but destroying other people's lives, strangers' lives. A disease like alcoholism permeates everything. It's like the poisonous chemical, DDT, that was used to treat crops all over the country and the world that then caused people to have all kinds of different lymphomas and cancers. Ah, sorry about the digression, Mom. Back to New Year's Eve. I chose it because it's the one night of the year that Dad could justify his drinking. And what a bunch of bullshit that is, justifying becoming a mean, violent prick. The one night that people have permission to beat their wives or husbands or abuse their kids, an alcoholic's dream. Do drug addicts have a night like that? Halloween, maybe. I don't know. As you know, Mom, my all-time number one addiction is food. It's my drug, and a brutal one. What cartel brought Krispy Kreme donuts into the country? Food addiction is an epidemic in America because we produce so much processed fast food, horrible bad food, but also delicious healthy food. We have the best and the worst. I'm not sure when my food addiction started, Mom, but you must have known, right? That bread and butter combination is what really did me in, Mom, and led to so many other fattening foods. Or foods in fattening portions. Yes, bread and butter were probably my gateway drug. It's so freaking cold in Minnesota, Mom. I love coming back here for this show, and all the other times I've come back during the year to see family and to perform. It's not terrible tonight, but sometimes it'll be like 14 below or 36 below with the wind chill or something insane like that. I need to make sure I have my whole tundra outfit when I get here. I get so bundled up that if I fell over, I'd never be able to get up on myself. When I'm bundled up like that, and I smile, you can only see my eyes and my signature gap between my teeth. I think another reason I do this special evening, so I don't have to go outside from one celebration to another, alcohol or no alcohol. I'm just glad for the past 2.5 decades I've hosted people on New Year's Eve so they could laugh their asses off. Laughter is the addiction everybody should have. Something that gives us great joy without any harm. Well, except peeing your pants. It's my favorite addiction. Happy New Year. You're hungry for laughs, son. Louie. If you're suffering out there from domestic violence or substance abuse, please refer to the PDF that came with this program for more information. Yes, man. Hey, Mom. I had a gig over Valentine's Day at the Horseshoe Bay Resort near Austin, Texas. Working with Martha Kelly, one of the co-stars of Baskets. She plays Martha Brooks. She's a great comedian, and it was the first time that we were working together like this. The first time I worked anywhere since Baskets began airing, which is exciting. The place is interesting. I don't know if I should call it a rich people's resort, but it certainly isn't a poor people's resort. Kind of like a Poconos of Texas. Or back home, Minnesotans with more money than we have would say, we're going to the lakes. A place where you have to save up a little to get away. At Horseshoe, it looked like the well-to-do and the not-so-well-to-do came together for a wonderful weekend of golf, fun in the sun, and some entertainment. Maybe it was richer than I first thought. As we drove by the big houses with big sheds, I asked the driver why the sheds are so big, and he said they were private airplane hangars connected to the house. Imagine being rich enough to have your own airplane hangar next to your house. Or one of the multiple houses, probably. Wow, Mom, I gotta work harder and make some more money. I need a hangar. Later, I had a really nice dinner with Roger's family and Nettie, who came up from Houston and Austin. Anne loves seeing everybody. Then Martha and I met backstage, prepping for the show. Even though Martha was opening for me, and I was the headliner, I wanted to introduce her. Something I learned from Joan Rivers, who was wonderful and generous that way. So, while we were there behind the curtain, and we could hear everyone in the banquet hall eating and talking over dessert, I took the microphone and said, "Welcome, everybody, and happy Valentine's Day!" We heard some cheers and some applause. "I'm really excited to have this next comedian open for me tonight. I work with her on a little show called Baskets." As soon as I said that, we heard more people applauding and cheering. It was the first time I realized that people were actually watching the TV show. Oh, so exciting. We had a great show, a ton of fun. Martha was fantastic. And we each went to bed, and I got up the next morning to head home. This week, I'm doing a conversation on something called Reddit. I'll explain it later. But I said yes because I've been saying yes a lot this year. In fact, when I got the role in Baskets, I made two promises to myself. One, don't complain. Two, always say yes. I've been able to stick to them so far. I'm proud of myself for that. Yes, complaint-free, Louie. Podcasts and home. Hey, Mom. Well, I just finished a Reddit AMA, which stands for Ask Me Anything. It was an interview with a lot of strangers where different people asked me questions and I answered them on my computer and everyone can read the exchange on their computer screen or on their phone. Yes, Mom, on their phone, but not like the ones we used when we were growing up. Even though everyone's in their own home or office or maybe even on the bus or at the beach. It was fun, and people were really engaged. What an interactive world it's become, Mom. In fact, I'm not even writing this letter. I'm talking into the microphone that's on my phone. Yes, Mom, on my phone. Just talking into my phone, which doubles as a recording device, and a camera, and a calendar, and a calculator, and a photo album, and a jukebox, and a place to shop, and a place to make reservations, and a place to play card games and other games, and a small TV set, and lots more. And can you believe it? After I talk these words into my phone, it also transcribes what I say into written words. For the most part, it gets the words right, but technology is not perfect, and now and then it misses. Like, when I said the word words in the last sentence, it spelled it out warts. Maybe I didn't pronounce it clearly enough. A small price to pay for convenience. Once I said acknowledgement, but what was typed was egg knowledge meant. You had so much egg knowledge, Mom. You made them great. Scrambled, sunny side up, soft boiled, hard boiled, poached. You always loved poached. I think you enjoyed the challenge of making the perfect poached egg. Anyway, it's a technology I appreciate, and I can talk a lot faster than I can type. In a couple of days, I fly back to Minnesota to host a big shindig thrown by the Bloomington Convention and Visitor Bureau. This great evening where they give out awards to all those wonderful people who work in Bloomington's service industry, the best of the best of the area's hotel staffs. So they have Bellman of the Year, Maid of the Year, Concierge of the Year, and Front Desk Person of the Year. I'm sure I'll really enjoy hosting it. I think every day should start with an award, an acknowledgement, maybe even acknowledgement. You know, you get applause when you come downstairs in the morning, just like an actor or a singer or comedian comes out on stage, or a great athlete comes out onto the field, or the court, or the ice. I think everybody should be treated wonderfully and applauded to recognize what they do and that they make people happy and make their lives easier. We need more of people, all people, not just the stars and the louder people being treated special. Earlier today, I did the Marc Maron podcast. A podcast is a crazy thing, Mom. You'd really love it. It's kind of an offshoot of a radio show that's a CB radio plus a ham radio. Like where people used to talk to each other and other people with CBs and ham radios could listen, especially truckers and people who are good with electronics or who lived in the middle of nowhere and craved human contact. Only now you don't have to drive trucks or live in the Sandwich Islands to listen. Ham radio, Sandwich Islands, okay, I'm hungry. Anyway, you can wake up or go to sleep or exercise to people talking about cooking, murders, baseball, politics, arthritis, or how they became a comedian. Mark is a very talented comic and a friend I worked with at the Comedy Store in Los Angeles in the 80s when he and I were starting out. He was one of the first guys to understand how podcasts could really be used, and he devoted his to interviewing fellow comedians. And then his podcast got so popular that he even interviewed President Barack Obama, our first black president. Yes, Mom, it didn't take as long for it to happen as everyone thought. Mom, I was thinking that I would do a podcast where it's me, Louie, planning to host a key figure from my life growing up. Say a third grade teacher or a dentist or a childhood friend. In every installment of the show, the promised guest doesn't show up for a lame reason. And guess who shows up? Dad. And then Dad is the guest every week. And that would be really funny because then I could do both voices and include yours, Mom. So you, Dad, and me would be doing a podcast every week. It would be so much fun. Mom, the day after the awards event in Bloomington, I'm having lunch with Tommy, Lisa, Jimmy, and whatever other Andersons want to show up whenever I'm in the Twin Cities. Then I head off to Florida for a couple days of relaxation before I do a week at the Off the Hook Comedy Club in Naples, Florida, which I really love. I wish you were here to have lunch with us, Mom. We all do. Love, Louie. That was your baby, Mom. Hey, Mom. I have not written in many days. It's been too tough. Last Saturday, I landed in Minneapolis, went right to the DoubleTree Hotel in Bloomington, and it was already 5:15. I had to go on at 8:30, but I was exhausted. I snuck in a 15-minute, not really a nap, but I lay there very still and silent and recited some prayers and a mantra and took some deep breaths. My friend Jason Schomer, a talented comedian, came by the room and we laughed and had a good time. And I talked about an idea for an animated series that I wanted him to take part in. We talked about life and all things that come with being a comic. I said how I love being so busy and traveling and doing things that make people happy. I got to the Bloomington Diamond Service Awards event around 7. The crowd was ready to honor some truly deserving people. The award winners were lovely, and I got to do a fun stand-up set. People seemed to really like it. Afterward, in my room, I ate some room service, relaxed, and in my prayers that night, I thanked God for all the people and all the good things in my life. Sweet dreams, that's what I thought. But you never know, Mom. The next day, a car picked me up and headed to Newport to pick up Tommy. Remember Newport, Mom? The old dump was there. It must have been on Native American land because I remember Dad negotiating with the Midwakanin Sioux who lived near there so he could take junk out of the dump. People discard stuff there, and he always found things he could fix or use or make better. It was embarrassing and interesting at the same time. Dad taught me about the value of things without saying a word or knowing he was teaching me. So many things that seem broken or useless can actually be fixed. That's easy if it's mechanical or electronic or a piece of furniture. It's a lot harder when it's a person or a family. Anyway, I picked Tommy up. He did not look good. I almost said something but thought, well, maybe he didn't sleep much or maybe he just had a bad night. I did ask if he was okay and he said he was fine. But Tommy, the truth ranger, was never one to tell the truth about how he was feeling. So I got into the habit long ago of not asking, which was wrong. I should have pushed. We went to Applebee's, not my first choice, but the rest of the group, including Jimmy and his new love, Leela, and David Anderson and his new wife, Melcar, was happy because everybody can find something they want there. And you can get two entrees plus one appetizer for $20, which is one of Tommy's favorite things. He got the shrimp and the pasta, I think. He looked like he was really enjoying himself, and we all were, though Lisa couldn't make it because something came up with her. We had some good laughs and took some pictures and then hung out a long time, maybe 3 or 4 hours. I'm glad we did. I was leaving that evening for Florida, so we wrapped it up. I had to be at the airport for a 5:30 flight to Tampa, and I told the driver first to drop Tommy off at the house. We got there, Tommy said, "You want to come up, look at my neighbor's new 50-inch 4K TV? I was just too tired. I asked him again if he was okay. You know me, Mom. I always want to know how everybody else is doing. And he said, "Yeah, I'm good." We hugged, I told him I loved him, and he told me he loved me. I headed to the airport, got to my hotel in Florida about 9:30, and fell asleep by 10. The next morning, I hung out with my great friend Abraham and other friends from down there. And somehow, I really don't know how, we all decided to watch the latest Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie. We muted our phones during the movie. Afterward, I forgot to look at my phone and didn't check it until I returned to the hotel lobby. That's when I saw all the calls I'd missed. I recognized some of them, a couple from Lisa, a call from Jimmy, a call from Shanna, and some I didn't recognize with Minnesota area codes. "Mom, you know that terrible dread you feel when you see missed calls from people trying to get a hold of you? In your day, it would have been an upsettingly large number, a blinking red number of calls left on the answering machine. Dear God, it's overwhelming. Something happened to somebody. I felt like fainting, as I filled with sorrow and dread and all the different terrible things you can actually feel at once, but mostly dread. Oh, no, 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 no. No calls from Tommy. Shit. Oh, God, please, no. I called Lisa. She said, "It's Tommy." "That was it, Mom. Tommy. Oh, Mom. I fell apart. I completely fell apart. It hurt me when Dad died. It destroyed me when you died and when Kent and Rhea and Mary and Roger and Billy and Sheila died. And now my baby brother Tommy. My little brother Tommy. Oh, why didn't I take him to the hospital? I was wailing in the lobby of the hotel. Why would God do this? Oh, God. Thank God Abraham was with me. He said almost nothing. He understood. He knew Tommy. He loved Tommy. He knew what we meant to each other. I made it up to my hotel room somehow with Abraham's help. Inside, I writhed with pain, rolled from one side of the couch to the other, moved to the chair, moved to the corner, leaning against the wall, knowing I would find no comfort there either, or anywhere. We were supposed to be the last ones left, Louie and Tommy. Tommy and Louie, to tell stories about all the others. He and I grieve together, grow old together. He was my number one cheerleader, always rooting for me. He was proud of me. He loved being my little brother, the Truth Ranger. He was the guy who worked so hard to get off the streets. Tommy was my shadow, my other half in life. We were the last two in the family, the two afterthoughts, he and I almost more like grandchildren than children. And we suffered together the terror of Dad's rage, the abuse. We shared the same fear and the frightening cruelty from back then and throughout our childhood. We had a silent understanding between us. Nobody had heard from him that day. His body was found early afternoon. Lisa went to the apartment. He was on the edge of his bed, on his back, his arm over his chest like he had started to get up and then grabbed at his heart. Oh, heart attack probably. I should have taken him to the hospital. I should have gone up and seen the 4K TV. I was glad he had the 2 for $20 at Applebee's. It wasn't fair. It was life. I probably couldn't have stopped it. Mom, please tell me he's with you and you are both okay. Your broken-hearted son, Louie. A moment I think I wish I hadn't missed, followed by one I'm so happy I didn't. Hey, Mom, while Tommy's body lay at the Cremation Society of Minnesota, waiting to be turned into ashes, I was in the car to Tampa Airport to head back to Minneapolis. Though even if I had been in Minneapolis, I'm not sure I could have handled it. At times in life, there are no words, no thoughts. There is only loss and sorrow heavier than anything you've lifted or deeper than anything you've ever experienced. The only word I can think of for how it felt to me, deafening. It was as if everything else was pushed out by the loss and sorrow, so that I couldn't hear or feel anything else. When the cremation was over, Justin, one of your grandsons, Jimmy's third son, called me like I asked him to. By this time I was sitting on the plane about to pull away from the gate. The flight attendant asked me again to shut down my device, but I only pretended to obey, then continued the conversation. My seatmate, rather than giving me the evil eye, seemed sympathetic. She could hear that I was having a genuinely important conversation, which was making me very emotional. Justin told me that he had been there throughout the process with Tommy's body, saying, "I'm right here with you, buddy. I'm right here with you," until it was ashes. I could barely hold it together. Even though I wasn't thinking about my seatmate and another part of my brain, I was so appreciative for her understanding. When the flight attendant passed our way again, she did not have an understanding expression. I had to hang up if I didn't want to be one of those people. I felt drained. I was so sad about Tommy. So sad that I wasn't there with him for the final moments, and so sorry that Justin had to be there alone with him. The plane began to taxi. I looked over at my seatmate. I could tell from her expression that she felt for me. "I wish I could get a sign," I said to her, barely above a whisper. I was crying in front of a stranger, and I didn't care. I just wish I could get a sign from God that everything is okay. Something. She nodded and faced the window. The plane turned onto the runway, and as it did, Mom, I swear to you, the biggest, brightest field of sunlight poured through the window, blinding me and my seatmate. She turned to me, her eyes wider than it looked like they should go. My eyes must have been just as wide. A tremendous peace washed over me. "Oh, Tommy. Louie."
Life is funny. Hey, Mom. Now that the first season of Baskets has aired, fans of the show and of Christine have been communicating with me, sharing their thoughts about what they see in her and the memories of their moms, too. It's beautiful. The show got picked up for a second season, which is great, but I received word the day after Tommy died, so I was in a fog. I'm still in a fog. I've lost so many siblings, Mom, too many. I can't believe it's 7 sisters and brothers I've lost. What an awful number for that description. It was 6, and now it's 7. You lost siblings too, Mom. Your sister Aunt Iona died years after you did. But you lost Perry, who I got my middle name from. And there was Viroka, your sister you never knew. How did she get that name? Another question I wish I had asked you. Viroka, who got pneumonia when she was a baby and died at 2 years old. Aunt Iona said she remembered Grandma Bertha sobbing and sobbing when the baby died. So many tears are shed, Mom. When Uncle Perry went to visit Aunt Iona and Uncle Ike in South Dakota, he had a dog, and Iona wouldn't let pets in the house. So Shanna, who was a little girl then and living with them, of course wanted to see the dog. And she walked outside the house with Uncle Perry to his car, where he had kept the dog. With the windows almost closed, she saw this little chihuahua in the car, and Shanna says the dog was crying. Not just whimpering, like dogs do, but looking up at Shanna and Uncle Perry and shedding actual tears. Just like a human. She said, "I never got over it." Love, Louie. Comedian, movie star, leader of the free world.
Hey, Mom.
I'm in the green room for Live with Kelly and Michael, preparing to talk baskets. I don't want to sound big-headed, but I always thought I could be a great actor. I dreamed I could win an Oscar someday, either for acting or directing. I dreamed I would be one of the very few performers to win an Oscar, a Tony, an Emmy, a Grammy. Well, I've won one of those so far, the Emmys for Life with Louis, though I've won some other awards too. A few years ago, I was on a TV show called Splash, which was a really great experience for me because I got to face my fear of heights by jumping into a swimming pool from a 10-meter diving board in front of lots of people live and millions more on TV. I couldn't turn back. Well, I could, but if I did, I'd have loads of shame and video evidence of it for eternity. Yes, it was quite a splash, Mom. I loved doing it. But besides giving me strength and some exposure to a younger audience, after I did my splash on Splash, the United States Diving Association gave me an award of sorts, making me an honorary member of the U.S. diving team. I guess when a 420-pound person jumps off a 10-meter diving board in front of a national TV audience, he should get something. The whole experience was a gift. I finally got a chance to climb that rope I never could in high school gym class. Not only climb, but climb to the top and leave my initials up there for all time. Where was I? Oh, right. Winning awards. Maybe I always thought too much of myself. Before I wanted to be a comedian, I wanted to be a politician. But only president, nothing short of that. Fortunately, I found stand-up comedy. You know, I wasn't much of a student. For a while after high school, I was employed by St. Joe's Home for Children in Minneapolis, working with kids from troubled homes. And the experience taught me a great deal, while at the same time it broke my heart, preparing me to be a better person someday. But I wanted to do comedy. I was lucky it came so naturally. I was able to make people laugh with just silence, which is a gift. Of course, you have to have lots of material, and I do, but if you can get people to laugh by just raising an eyebrow or barely twitching your mouth or being quiet, Jack Benny was the master. Anyway, I knew I had something because I would try to make people laugh and they would laugh. And then I would be serious and people would still laugh. I'm being serious, I would say. And then they would laugh even harder. You guys. Then I realized. All right, Louis, you came from a funny family, a funny, tragic, crazy family. When you're in a situation with an alcoholic parent or anyone who's crueler than usual, there's humor there. Because you have to find humor there, or you'll go crazy, or you'll kill yourself. Dad's knocked out from drinking. Fake stab him in the chest. Yeah, you'll be in a ton of trouble if he wakes up while you're doing it, but it's funny to do this to somebody who's caused you so much pain, and especially do it in front of your kid brother and make him laugh. And anyway, there's almost no chance the drunk is waking up. Or kneel behind your dad. Watch your brother kneel behind him, like you're fake pushing him down the basement stairs. Or lock the front door as your dad goes out to start the car in the freezing cold so he can't get back in. Cruelty begets cruelty. Do you have to be a cruel person to make such jokes? No. You do need to understand cruelty and possibly have actually experienced it so that you can find the humor in it. I really believe, Mom, that human beings have a cruel streak. You see it with chimpanzees. Sometimes chimps just randomly turn on each other or drive other chimps away or beat up a chimp that looks beat upable. I guess deep down, a lot of us are just bullies. Most of us handle it well. We've learned to repress that side. But when the opportunity arises for a weaker creature to be bullied, the less brave bullies in the group, the less evolved, less mature ones who can't manage our natural bullying tendencies spring into action. Chimps, humans, same thing. Now and then in my act, I do jokes that touch on real darkness, but I have to be very careful or the crowd gets sad and concerned for me. So then I go broad instead and jokes say about killing the whole family.
Or take the joke I came up with about hecklers. Once after a heckler said his piece and I dealt with him, I said to the audience, wouldn't it be something if one night I came out and did my routine and I killed a heckler? It would change comedy. Next week, I do my show and the guy starts in with me with, Louis, you suck. And then the guy next to him leans over and whispers, he killed a heckler last week. That would change things, wouldn't it? How did I turn into a comedian? Sometimes I like to think of myself as some sort of pod. The 10th child, the sadness and goofiness and fear and desire to make people smile and laugh, all brewing in me at some optimum chemical rate until it created me, Louis Anderson, stand-up comedian. So I went from dreaming about being president and helping people that way and making them like and love me for that to being a comedian and helping people that way and making them like and love me for that. It was a no-brainer because being funny was easy for me. Then I made either my greatest discovery or my biggest blunder. I created a fat character and started writing jokes about being fat. It made me very successful, but also put me in a corner, a place where it caused me great anxiety to lose weight. Because whenever I lost enough weight to notice, people would say to me the cruelest thing that they could possibly say, though they didn't realize it. Why would you want to get skinny? You won't be funny anymore. Oh, it really ticked me off. They thought I was funny because I was fat. Maybe that's all I am to some people, a fat comic. I just know that if I believed that, I'd be dead by now. I believe I'm a comic who happens to be fat. People don't like to see other people change. It's jarring. It's a threat to their own inability to change. Richard Pryor quit drinking and doing drugs, and suddenly people didn't think he was funny anymore. Richard was funny till the day he died. It's just that some of his fans didn't want him to exercise the demons that for so many years had animated his comedy and intelligence, and their memory of him. They liked that Richard Pryor. Louis, where are the fat jokes we love? I assumed a character that is mostly sweetness and niceness, not the worst character in the world for me to play, Mom, but it didn't give people enough and it didn't give me enough. You need some sides to go with your entree. You need horseradish on your roast beef. Who wants to see sweet and nice with no loose cannon at the end of it? The thing that made Archie Bunker so popular was that he could say the most horrible thing, but then he could also find redemption in himself. He could repent. He could be all of us. I never knew how to be all of us until I put that dress on as Christine Baskets. With Christine, I can be mean and nice, happy and sad. I can be everything in that character. I should have found that sort of character a lot earlier and stuck to my guns that I could play and be someone who's not just Mr. Nice Fat Guy. Mr. Fat Nice Guy? Are they two different people? But maybe, Mom, I wasn't ready for that next character until now. It's easy for me to blame the industry or the culture. But I have to take responsibility for my choices. No one twisted my arm to do comedy and pursue the opportunities that I did. Yes, it's hard to stick to your guns in show business, but you have to do just that before it gets too late. When you're a comedian or even an actor, at some point, you better know who you are. You better stick to who you really are and not try to sell anything else, because if you do, it'll backfire. You won't be considered anything. And if there happens to be videos and recordings of you performing in a way that's not really you, and there will be, you'll die every time you have to watch it. Is the message of this letter to thine own self be true? Not to knock Shakespeare, but it's more than that. To thine own self be everything you are, be everything that's true about you. The good thing, Mom, is that I may have saved the best for last, or let's say, my best for later. We serve dessert at the end of the meal because if we ate it first, none of the rest of the food would ever get eaten. This Christine Baskets character might be the beginning of a great new period for me. New kind of roles. Who knows? I might even play a man next. Love, Louis. Make your date.
Hey, Mom.
Happy Mother's Day. Remember when you and I appeared on TV for that Mother's Day special on Twin Cities Live with the other Twin Cities personalities and their moms? You were so nervous, I could see it. But you held it together and turned out to be the star, no question. Very funny and very sassy. I was the butt of all your jokes, a lot of fat jokes, and I didn't mind one bit. Your timing was beautiful. Shanna was in the audience. She even cried. Anyway, today I did this Mother's Day event in Detroit, something I started doing a couple of Mother's Days ago. That's when my manager, Amos, asked me if I would perform at a benefit to help raise money for this program started by his sister, Sonia, a maternal fetal medicine doctor, an obstetrician specializing in high-risk pregnancies. It's called Make Your Date, or, as I like to call it, Baby Mama. When I heard what they did, of course I said yes, partly because Amos's family has kind of adopted me, partly because it's such a good cause, and partly because you had all those kids, Mom. Make Your Date helps pregnant teens and young women in Detroit who don't have the means to get car fare for their regular appointments at clinics or with OBGYNs. It helps moms with resources like health insurance, home visits, and prenatal care. And it provides them with a plan to help manage doctor's appointments and other steps important to a healthy pregnancy, birth, and baby. Make Your Date gives these young moms-to-be classes to learn more about their pregnancy and health. So far, the organization has helped more than 6,000 young women. When you're pregnant and poor, and maybe feel more stressed and crappy because the guy's not involved, it's way too easy for these girls and young women not to schedule regular checkups or miss them because they simply can't get off from work or school or they lack the money to go. They might think it's not that important to make the date for those appointments. By missing them and not finding out important things about the developing fetus and their own health, the young women increase the chance of a low birth weight delivery and deliver their babies preterm, which is the leading cause of infant mortality. Detroit has the nation's second highest infant mortality rate after Cleveland. So this great organization steps in to make these mothers-to-be more aware and able to get the help they need, and most important, the support they lack. Support goes a long way in times of need. Remember how much we used to get when we were on welfare, Mom? $53 a month? It just about paid for rent in the projects. Mom, how could I not melt for an organization like Make Your Date? You were pregnant more than half your life, weren't you? Okay, not quite, but it must have seemed that way for a couple of decades there. That's one of the reasons I wanted to help. Plus, having five sisters of my own, all of whom gave birth, each year I do the benefit. I think of you and how important it was for you to get to those appointments. Yet, how proud you were, even when you didn't have enough gas money or bus money or any money. Being poor is a drag. I remember we got help from the welfare and we weren't supposed to have a color TV, so when the welfare lady came by to check on us, we had to hide the Magnavox. What a terrible situation being penalized for having things that Dad actually got at the dump and fixed himself. And if he made too much money at his job, we would lose all the benefits we received from aid to families with dependent children. Once you're poor, they really want to keep you poor. We should support people a lot more, Mom. Yeah, I know people take advantage of welfare and food stamps. I know people take advantage of the government, especially really rich people. As usual, though, those who misuse the system cause a problem for those folks who don't. There's a whole big group of poor people out there that are so thankful and grateful for the help they get. I think about how you and Dad were so resourceful at cutting corners, cutting coupons, and even cutting our hair. Mom, that terrible bowl cut. Remember those times when we just had enough money to pay either the gas or the electric bill, but not both? And you, of course, would pay the gas bill because we needed it for heating and cooking. So it was dark. You lit a lot of candles, including all the church candles you stole. And remember, Mom, how we somehow had a Hanukkah menorah? You're such a pack rat like me, which holds 9 candles. And even though your family goes all the way back to the Mayflower and Dad's family is Scandinavian Lutheran, you use the menorah to help light the house? That was a mitzvah, Ma. You're always resourceful, Mom, which poor people have to be so much more than those people who aren't poor. Your kindness saved us, Mom, literally. We were poor and there were so many of us. But because you were sweet and thoughtful and so beloved by your friends, they helped us get through. Every few weeks after Monty's husband left for work, we would go over to her place by the ham brewery, and she would open up a big freezer, and she would take out those big roasts and give them to you for all of us. Monty had as big a heart as you. There's pride and then there's survival. You always knew what mattered. I remember Halloween for the candy, but also for how all of us kids from the poorer families would go either as ghosts or bums because everyone at least had a sheet, and hopefully it was clean. Anyway, Mom, helping with Make Your Date is about the best thing I can think to do on Mother's Day, and it helps all of those young women, and especially those babies. And one of those babies might one day save us all. That's what I always think. Who is going to save us? Is it going to be just one person, a bunch of people? I'm counting on it. I mean, I know we all have to save ourselves, but you get it. Someone to save us from all the other big scary stuff out there. I hope somebody comes along and says the right thing that sparks us to start getting along better and to start feeling more inclusive toward one another and to start being less divisive. We really need people to start reaching out from church pew to church pew, neighbor to neighbor. Make us realize that we all are in the same boat and it's sinking and no one seems to care and the people who aren't helping are the ones who aren't in the boat, or they think that they aren't, but they really are, right alongside with the rest of us, and they're going down with all of us, unless we all take a hard look at who we are and what we are doing. I try to take a hard look, but I also know I can be selfish at times. I need to work even more at being a nicer person, a more giving person. Make Your Date might just save lives. Healthier babies will be born in the world. Pretty fantastic. You saved our lives, Mom. I don't think you looked at it like that, but you did. I have so many more questions for you, Mom, like, did you give birth to any babies at home? I remember that you said when Kent was a baby there was no crib, so he slept in the top drawer of the dresser. They're selling that concept again with baby boxes, Mom. What goes around comes around. I guess because so many of the old ideas were actually pretty smart. History matters. It matters if we're going to make the best of things in our own individual lives, in America, in the world. What are we doing to our world? God, I sound like a preacher or a blowhard. Mom, you always like to call people blowhards when they were being, well, blowhards. Sorry about that. But I know you're proud of me for doing what I did today. I hope I wasn't too hard of a birth, Louie. Sweet Lisa. Hey, Louie. Mom was a very strong woman. She came from a well-to-do family, and then she married Dad. She loved him so much. They had nothing, but she didn't care. That's love. She figured out how to get by. Her love and kindness melted your heart. Everyone loved her sweetness. She was always fun. Mom, I miss your love and the sweet morning call up the stairs. Lisa, Louie, time to get up for school. She was never mean. I think about how great she was, even though Dad made life hell for her. She was so strong. She was the best cook in the world when we had food to eat. She made the best fried chicken in a cast iron skillet. And the best angel food cake. Oh, I can't forget the best over-easy eggs ever. Yummy. Also, the Coke and tuna special sandwich with Mom. We'd go to Woolworths, and we'd have a chocolate Coke and a tuna sandwich. Oh, it was such a special Mom time. And she was always right. She would tell us, don't do something or this will happen. And she was always right. I think she had psychic abilities.
Remember when Mom started wearing pantsuits? We had to show her how to walk in them. She was adorable. How she held her legs tight together, if you saw it, it was so funny. She was a doll. Because of her, I'm a better person. I saw her struggle so much with Dad's drinking, I knew I would never be like him. Don't get me wrong, I love Dad. I just didn't like his drinking. I love Christine in baskets. That is Mom. She would love the show. She always wore dresses and loved to wear earrings and brooches. You're a doll doing Mommy. Love, Lisa. Big Shot. Hey, Mom. Everyone wants to be a big shot in their family. I don't care who you are. When the main driving force in your career and your life is to become a success, a big shot, you're really doing it so you can be a big shot in your family, with your brothers and sisters, with your mom and dad, with your friends, and your girlfriend and boyfriend, who you grew up with, or maybe ignored you. You want to be a big shot in your neighborhood, your community. Of course you do. You devote all your energy to becoming a big shot so that when you get back to town, back to the family home, back to your brothers and sisters, back to the family reunion, people say as you pass, he did well. He's a big shot. The most important thing about being a big shot is not to act like one. Because then you're not a big shot. You're a little shit. Your son, Louis. Stranger Things. Hey, Mom. Recently, I started waking up to the sight of moths and hummingbirds, big fat hummingbirds the size of parakeets, flitting around my bedside lamp even though it wasn't on. Or spiders running up the wall really fast and disappearing. They never run toward me, always up and away, and they look back at me while they're running as if they've been found out. It's as if they are spying on me, checking on me. It's happened numerous times. They're not dreams. I don't know what they are. It's been 3 months since Tommy passed, and I've been wondering more and more about things like that. Now we've lost Kent and Rhea, Mary and Roger, Sheila and Billy, and now Tommy. 7 of the 11 of us. 7-Eleven, the convenience store. This is not convenient. 7-Eleven at the craps table. Whenever you go buy it at the casino, you hear, "Come on, 7! Come on, 7!" I'd rather have 11 than 7. Oh, Mom, that sounds so sad. I can never play craps again. Just the 4 of us left now. Jimmy, Shanna, Lisa, and me. Numbers 5, 6, 9, and 10. That's our order. The final 4. The "we dodged a bullet so far" 4. Anyway, I feel as if the moths and spiders and hummingbirds are there to send me love, because that's what I feel from them, love. These big moths and plump hummingbirds. The birds are almost close enough to touch, and yesterday, as I watched one of them, I said out loud, "This is not a hallucination! This is real!" And right then, the hummingbird darted behind the lamp, and then darted back out and looked at me, and then darted back, and then I put my hand out, and it came a little closer, and I reached out, and it flew to the window, and it disappeared. Where'd it go? Where do the spiders disappear to when they get high enough up the wall? Or the moths? Have they come to make contact? When the spiders and hummingbirds leave, it's usually through the wall or into some abyss, not out the window. Were they ever here? Were they hallucinations? Mom, are they communications from you and Tommy and Kent and Rhea and Mary and Roger and Sheila and Billy and even Dad? Actually, I wouldn't mind hearing from him either. Maybe he's a spider. It's not the first time something like this happened. A month after Tommy died, I entered the bathroom of my hotel, turned on the light, and suddenly there were colors. Colors I'd never seen before, moving around the bathroom. I felt like something was trying to work itself out, and my mind immediately went to the thought of Tommy, and also Sheila and Rhea and Billy, those 4. None of the others. I have no idea why. "Who's there?" I said out loud. I wasn't scared. I felt as if I could reach out to them, but it also felt as if I couldn't get all the way there. I couldn't reach them, but I could witness what was going on, and in a way participated in what was going on, and be comforted by them in their trying to work out whatever they were trying to work out. Maybe they were as sad about their having left as I was about their leaving. It happened the next night, too, same thing, only this time I didn't worry about what had happened. I lay down and fell asleep, deeply, with love, number 10, number 5, number 6, and number 9.
Stand up, people. Hey, Mom. I'm in Washington, D.C., where earlier today we taped a tribute to Joan Rivers at the Kennedy Center. Melissa, Joan's daughter, called a couple of months ago asking me to participate. Given what Joan meant to me, of course I said yes. And thinking about the sudden passing of someone I so admired as a comedian and as a person got me thinking of all the comedians who aren't around anymore, many of whom left suddenly or too early. Robin Williams, Sam Kennison, Phil Hartman, Chris Farley, Bill Hicks, John Belushi, Mitch Hedberg, Gilda Radner, Andy Kaufman, Patrice O'Neill, John Candy, Madeleine Kahn, Bernie Mac. The list is too damn long, Mom. Not everyone is lucky enough to hang around like Bob Hope or George Burns, who both died at 100. I think of the comedians who are gone and who were so influential to my career. Henny Youngman, king of the one-liners and terrible violin playing, really liked me and gave me encouragement early on that I desperately needed. When he hosted the first annual comedy competition in St. Louis, and I was disappointed to take third place, he handed me my trophy, a plastic banana, and whispered to me, "You were the best. You should have won." You can imagine how that feels to a young comedian. Later on, he hired me to write for him. When Rodney Dangerfield came to town to play the Carlton Celebrity Room, all the young, aspiring Twin Cities comics were so excited to see him. I had read in an article that he liked scotch, so I bought a bottle of Glenlivet and balloons and presented them to him. He never forgot the gesture. Then there's Joan. I first met her in Minneapolis in the very early 1980s, just before I moved to Los Angeles. She saw my act and loved it. "You're a natural," she said. From then on, we stayed in touch. She told people about me, opened doors, and after I moved west and got on The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson and tasted some more success, and Joan got her own talk show, I was the first comedian she asked to be on it. Lots of potential guests said no because they heard Johnny was furious with her for starting her own show and competing with him. The word spread that if you did Joan's show, you would be blacklisted from Johnny's. I said yes to Joan anyway, and I'm glad I did. She was doing something monumental, a woman getting her own talk show. She'd been good to me, and I liked and admired her. And also, I did it because she picked me first. Growing up, I was almost always the last kid picked for any team. Joan was known as the hardest-working comedian in the business. She was a different kind of comedian from me. I told stories with jokes in them, more of the mold of Jonathan Winters, with some easy Jack Benny and Bob Hope pacing thrown in there, too. But I felt I could learn much from watching how seriously she took what she did. And she had to do it even harder and better than that because of the misogyny in show business and comedy, especially back then. At that time, a woman was never considered equal in stand-up, no matter how funny. More than any other female comic, more than Phyllis Diller, Lily Tomlin, or Toadie Fields, Joan made it possible for the success of so many of today's great female comedians who regularly pack huge theaters or play Vegas or have cable comedy specials. Yet, even today, if you read Twitter and other social media, it's incredible how brutally critics and anonymous commenters, almost always men, go after female comics. They do it in a way they never do it with male comics. I was genuinely moved that I was asked to sit in and host Joan's show after her husband Edgar's tragic suicide. I saw Joan when she was 76 years old on her knees crawling around on stage at the Venetian doing a bit, and I remember thinking, I don't know if I could do that at her age. I don't know if I could do it at my age.
Here she was, 20 years older than me, on all fours, and I'm just trying to fit my fat butt into a seat. I always felt that Joan absolutely lived for the audience.